Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Friday. It's August 2nd, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. My name is Hezzy Eris. This is Westchester on the Level. What an exciting day. Actually, it started off with a missed heartbeat, actually, or two or three, because I was trying to sign in to the radio show, to the broadcast, and we're allowed to do so only 15 minutes before the beginning of the program. Well, I couldn't believe it. It wasn't until 3 minutes to 10 o'clock in the morning that all of a sudden it started to function. So it was just amazing. It was just literally amazing that it worked. And so I was freaking out because here we're supposed to have one of the most fantastic guests we ever have, and that's Ossining Mayor Victoria Garrity. So I was just about ready to dial her up and then realized, oh, thank God we're up and running. So this was fantastic. So I see she's here. Good morning. Good morning, Mayor. What a pleasure to have you on. I was freaking out this morning. I didn't think I'd be able to connect. Oh, my God. You know, it's one thing, you know, when things befall you and there are issues, but when other people are involved, you know, it's like, it's not an embarrassment. It's like, oh, my God, what have I done? You know, I've just wasted somebody's half hour day. Oh,
well,
too much.
I'm
anyway,
delighted
how are
that
you?
It all worked out. I'm doing well. Thank you, Hezzy. How are you today?
Thank God. Okay. I'm excited because there's so much good stuff happening in Ossining. I don't know how you do it. I mean, are you baking? What's going on here? Well, the thing that excited me the most actually was the Ossining Children's Center facility, the one located on State Street. And you had a groundbreaking. And tell us about the groundbreaking, why it's important. And the best part of all is tell us about the people who were attended the groundbreaking.
Well, I think you may have seen the photo of the most adorable people who attended the groundbreaking, which is some of the first grade students who benefit from the programming that they have at the Ossining Children's Center. So the Ossining Children's
right.
Center is a real story that tells the story of Ossining and the kind of community that we are, because it was founded over 125 years ago. They had they're almost at 130 years old now, and they were founded by members of the community who realized that there were a number of workers who had come to Ossining, and husbands had gotten injured and could no longer work, and therefore the mothers had to go to work, and all these children needed childcare. So it was started by other folks in the community who realized that there was a need. And so it was revolutionary at the time because childcare facilities of this nature just didn't exist 130 years ago in very, very small numbers and certainly nothing in our region. So it was an innovative solution that was born out of a need in our community and out of the kindness and appreciation for our neighbors that those early Ossining residents showed. And it's just grown ever since. And the Ossining Children's Center starts with children who are babies and helps children all the way through after-school programs for kids. And they
Amazing.
Also work closely with the Ossining School District to be part of the preschool program and have the same curriculum that we do in the public schools so that families who have, children who are of the age to go to public pre-K, but families who have a need for an extended day childcare can actually have their children go to the Ossining Children's Center and get that same level of education for their 4 and 5 year olds that they would if they were participating in the regular public school universal pre-K program. So we really, we're really so fortunate to them as a community for all that they do. But they have expanded over the years to the right now. They're using, I believe, it is. Two adjacent houses for the younger kids, and then they have another house a block and a half away that's for the after-school program. And they're really, as they've grown, they've just taken on more property to be able to expand their programs, but they've really outgrown their existing structure. And so what you saw the groundbreaking for last week is this new facility that is going to be, that is now underway to be built on State Street, which is right in downtown Ossining, just you know, a block and a half away from the heart of our community, that major intersection. So it's walkable to so many folks in Ossining. They provide childcare on a sliding scale basis so that they to be able to support Ossining parents and families at every income level. And as you can see, there is there was many, many people there that day for the groundbreaking. This development, this new facility is possible because of tremendous amount, millions and millions of dollars of fundraising that has already happened. It was donors who purchased the property that it's on, which was had been a funeral home, and the which was a family business that that family had sold their business, and so when the property became available, it was purchased and donated to the Ossining Children's Center for this facility, and they've gone through their whole planning board process, and that's, you know, always been extra challenging. How do you figure out how to have all the parking that you need on site and nearby in a crowded, very bustling downtown? But they got through all of those hurdles, and now the work has finally begun. And it's going to be all of their programs from you know, infants up through the after-school program for the older kids will now be in one facility. It's a beautiful state-of-the-art facility. It's going to make great use of the land and be a great addition to the neighborhood. So we're very excited for that project to be underway. And it's, you know, Ossining does some things really well, including a lot of programs for children. And that's really one of the smartest ways that any community can invest in their future. And it's an essential part of economic development for our community, because if families can't have safe, quality, affordable child care, then they can't go to work confident that their children are going to be able to pick their children up after their day and have healthy, thriving children. And it's really an essential part for any successful community. And so we're really very, very fortunate in Ossining to have the Ossining Children's Center, and very excited for them taking this next step.
Well, you mentioned that you know, this goes back historically about 125 years ago, and it was not easy making a living in those days. And quite often the men would work in creating these bricks that we see. That was at one time there was a tremendous amount of trade of bricks that was made along the Hudson River, and that became the highway to traverse all those goods. But that had to be backbreaking work. And I guess it must have been a lot of people got hurt in the process. So it's amazing.
Was.
I don't think any other communities. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, in our case, we had major infrastructure projects in Ossining that were unique to our location, which is most notably the aqueduct. So that brought a lot of workers, a lot of stone workers during that era of immigration. And as you said, it was very physically demanding demanding work, and they certainly didn't have the safety restrictions and demands and healthcare that we do today. So the result
wasn't
was
around.
That, yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, very, very exciting to say the least. But then there was something else that almost seems to be a corollary, and even though it's not like an easy connect, but I think it's still there. And that is the outreach by the Ossining Police Chief Sylvester and you and the local community. How do you engender a sense of comfort, a lack of fear, especially now with so many issues coming about with regard to immigration, ICE, people being deported, you know, and yet you want to make the city and the village and the town, you want it to be a safe community for everyone. How do you engender that? Do people
Right. It's a really tough time in our country for any immigrant, even if they are documented, to feel safe in America. And especially in a community like ours, where we have a very large immigrant population, and we have had some ICE visits, thankfully, knock on wood, not too many lately, but we've had some. In fact, we've had at least one that was national news a couple of years ago, and Diego Puma was taken and sent back to his home in Ecuador. And the suggestion had been made, or the question had really been asked, that what exactly is the current policy and practice by the Ossining Police Department when ICE comes to town. And we had this conversation 2 years ago in light of the Diego Puma incident. And it's not a simple thing, unfortunately. It would be a lot simpler if we had more confidence in the behavior of ICE, or if we knew that the policies and practices were coming from a place of a genuine desire for what is in the best interest of the country. But unfortunately, so much of our immigration policy is being directed by angry, hateful, xenophobic, racist tweets. And so with that kind of leadership at the top of the federal government, it makes it, understandably very difficult for people on a local level to feel any sort of confidence in the behavior and intentions of ICE when they come to our community. So some communities have responded to that by the elected officials directing the police departments not to communicate or not to associate with ICE at all. We have a practice in Ossining that has been working for us, but that we reviewed this practice and then really got to the heart of what is our intention and what is our big picture goal when it comes to immigration concerns and their impact on our community. And really the biggest goal, the underlying goal, is for us to have a relationship of trust and communication between local law enforcement and the immigrant community. And how do we achieve that? And what behaviors might undermine that? And so it was suggested by a couple of colleagues on the village board that the village board should direct the police department not to observe ICE when they're in our community. And the current practice that we have is when ICE comes to Ossining, they tell the police that they're on their way and where they're going. And then our police accompany them. They observe what ICE is doing. They don't escort them. They don't advise them. They don't coordinate. But they do observe what's going on. And that was really a lot of our conversation at last week's work session was with the Board of Trustees and with this chief, the police chief, is to really understand what does that mean. Because it's given the questionable, at best, practices that we have become aware of with ICE nationally, it's a very legitimate concern if our local law enforcement is in any way facilitating inappropriate or unjust behavior. So what's the difference? Words really matter. Are we talking about coordination and even escorting? Or are we talking about observing? And what does that mean? And what are the benefits? And our police department feels that having more information is better for the people of our community. So what happens after ICE comes and they go to an address? If anyone is taken away, we now have the information that someone has been taken from a particular address. If after the police chief notifies me before it hits, hopefully before it hits social media, alerts me and the board and the town supervisor, if it's somewhere in the town, or it's generally in the village, the next call is to the superintendent of the school district to let him know that there was someone detained from a particular address in the village, and if there are any students in the Ossining School District who live at that address, that the school may want to be mindful of that and make sure that the child has the support that they need. And that's information, for example, that you wouldn't have if our local police didn't have communication with ICE. Now, some communities, and I'm actually having lunch this afternoon with the mayor of Peekskill. I spoke last week with the mayor of New Rochelle to ask more about what the motivation was for their policies. Because my understanding from New Rochelle is that ICE does notify them when they are coming to the community, but doesn't provide any further information beyond that. And then the New Rochelle police do not observe their operations when they're in their city. Fortunately, in the observations from our police department, they have not observed behavior that by ICE that has gotten dangerous for others in the neighborhood. Obviously, some people have been detained, and that's a very, very emotionally difficult and traumatic experience for everyone involved in that family. And that would happen whether our police officers were observing ICE's movements or not. And that's one of the frustrating things for all of us who do not agree with the increased practice by ICE to detain people and deport people who are not presenting a threat to Americans and to their neighbors and to the rest of our community. And that's the frustrating part, of course. Nobody wants dangerous criminals to be allowed to go free, but generally that's not what we're most seeing. It's tricky. We don't have details about some of the particular cases of who was taken and who was not. The one we know actually the most about is the Diego Puma, who was a high school senior who had been taken. It was prom night. You know, it was the day of the prom, so it became this big national news story. And his crime was simply that he had not been granted asylum. Not that he had committed a crime, just that he had not been granted asylum. He had gone through the courts. And his time was up, essentially. And so he wasn't presenting any threat. There was no violent crime that had been committed. And he was a young man who was, taken away from our community and sent back to a country where, the courts may not have found it him in need of asylum, but he and his family really felt that it was a dangerous situation for him. Mm-hmm. So that's a tough one for us to swallow. So when we see ICE coming and tearing apart families, and I have children in the school district, and my young son came home one day and told me about his classmate who was crying because her uncle was deported. You know, these things are very real and they're very real people, and they're felt very personally and very deeply in our community. So it is a conversation that we needed to have. And I'm cautiously optimistic that are going in a good direction for our community. And so what we're going to be discussing at next week's legislative session is where we are with the next steps. And the Aspen Police Department does a good job at doing community outreach, particularly for families and children. They're partnering with the school district this summer to do a series of block parties. They do, coffee with the cop. They do a lot of coffee with a cop, which is just friendly sort of chat over coffee at the coffee shop. They do, kickball with the cop, and they do a lot of mostly fun family activities. And one of the things we've asked them to increase is the amount of communication and opportunities. I'm sorry about that. There's something crazy happening on my phone. There we go. That they have to have conversations with adults. And that's one of the things we have asked them to increase, because with all of this fear that there is in our country, and particularly for our neighbors here in Ossining, having an opportunity to have conversations off camera with the chief of police and also with police officers who are native Spanish speakers, that can really make a difference in improving the communication between local law enforcement and immigrants in our community, Spanish-speaking residents of our community. And the police chief has done that in the past, but not regularly and not recently. So that's an example of one of the areas we have asked them to come up with a plan and tell us what is the plan moving forward to have increased, expanded, regular interactions between local law enforcement and the immigrant community, particularly when it comes to having a bunch of adults in the room asking questions. And when we've done that in the past, it was very soon after our current chief took office. He and I were part of a panel. There were actually four of us on the panel, myself and him and our town supervisor and a representative from the Board of Education. And we met in one of the school cafeterias to a packed room of Spanish-speaking parents. And many, many, many of the questions that they had to do with driver's licenses and when police stop them in cars or impounded. And, of course, that was 3 years ago now, before Trump was ever president and before the driver's license bill was ever changed. It was a really valuable, thoughtful conversation. And as much as anything, they got to ask their questions and be heard, and we got to be that much more aware of what are the priorities and concerns. And that certainly helps inform us when we're making decisions and advocating for different policies and how they're going to impact our community. And I'm so grateful that the green light legislation passed through Albany this year, and that is helps address some of the big concerns that the immigrant community had 3 years ago. Now, if we sat down in that room with those same parents today, that their questions would be very different, because now Donald Trump is president and now ICE is coming to communities like ours. And so those are the kind of forums that we are looking to increase and expand. And I think that that will be a valuable piece of our plan for improving the trust and communication between the police department and our immigrant community.
Well, I think you expressed it very well, but there's still a little bit of a disconnect for me in the sense that when you go to situations where there's tremendous opposition and yet there's some people might want to intrude or insinuate themselves in a positive way, such as being an observer, but it doesn't say observer on the police jacket. It says police.
And if
somebody comes into a war scene and they're a doctor, it says Médecins des Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, or something that will make people feel more secure because they've had more years to create an image of what Medicine mm-hmm. Without Frontiers means, or that sort of thing. So how does one broach that divide? Because it may not be as deep as it was maybe 3 years ago, but it's still there, and it's very visceral. So how does one change that dynamic? Do people see the Austin Police Department specifically? Because not all police departments are looked upon, as being benevolent, which is, I guess, the best word for it. I mean, I don't look at police in a negative way, but then I've never lived in a police state. I never felt that was the case, but there are many places that you could go that far, actually, and say that
yes,
those
including
exist.
Many
so
of the places that our local community members have come from, where anyone in a uniform is not to be trusted. Absolutely, which goes
Correct.
Both ways. Whether the local police are there or not, they may not be distinguished by the folks who are being visited by ICE. So I don't know that their presence on that occasion is going to the only reason it would make a difference is if something went horribly wrong and there needed to be some sort
right.
of protection for the community. So actually, I hope that their presence is not particularly notable. More valuable to us is if their presence, they can provide us with accurate information of what may have happened at a scene, and there have been occasions where they've not been present, and there has been misinformation that has been shared, and will go a whole day with misinformation being shared, and that's not in anyone's
right.
best interest ultimately either. What you're raising is the same question that we've been grappling with. Is it better for the police to not be present at all, because their presence can be interpreted as a tacit approval of any behavior by ICE, which we cannot control. Local police can't tell ICE where they should or shouldn't go, or who they should and shouldn't arrest. They don't have that
exactly.
power. So it is.
But I think if the message is that they are observers, and you repeat it over and over and over again, eventually people get to realize that in case I should visit a particular place, a home or whatever, or school or wherever they may go to pick somebody up, that they are observers. And then I guess people need to understand what their actual role will be when they observe. What do you do when you observe that someone is being violently manhandled or something like that?
Those are kind of questions that I think we do need to go into more deeply with the Austin Police Department. I know they're going to be hesitant to give us, responses to hypotheticals, because every situation is unique, and I understand that.
Right.
But
I wouldn't want them to go that way either.
Right. But it is a very reasonable question. And we part of what we were debating on the village board is, what do we want our role as elected officials to be in determining this policy? Because we do have an obligation to set big picture policy for all departments in the village of Austin, and we do. We pass a budget, we pass legislation, and we set big picture policy. And so what does that mean? And in some communities in Chicago, in Peekskill, in New Rochelle, in Portchester, their elected bodies have established a policy that their local law enforcement will not interact with ICE when they come to town, which is different than the typical interaction between local law enforcement and federal, any other federal law enforcement agency,
right,
where local law enforcement tends to be very integrally involved and prefers to be when federal law enforcement comes into their community. So we absolutely have the right to do that. And we actually have the obligation of oversight for every department, and most especially for the police department, because we are actually serve as the Board of Police Commissioners. So how we decide to enact, to act upon that is one of the questions that we had to ask ourselves. And we came down on the opinion that based on our understanding of the motivation and intention and experience of our police department and their recommendations, that we are comfortable with them continuing to observe ICE when they come into our community. We accept their understanding of it, that there are actual benefits to our community.
Yes.
To have this greater amount of information of what ICE is doing when they're in our community, who they are taking, and when this is happening,
and
where this is happening, and sometimes the why, although that won't necessarily be shared with us. We have accepted that in this case, more information is better. And what we have said to the police department is, look, I compared it to when we talked to our village engineer about something that people complain about a lot, paving. Every community wants more roads paved. So we hear a lot about that as a priority. And so what we say to them is, look, we need you to prioritize paving. This year, we're going to give you even more money in the budget. We'll give you as much money as you can possibly spend on paving roads for the next year, because that's a priority for us. But we're not going to tell you how to pave the road. We trust that you know how to mill the asphalt and deal with the drainage and all of the steps that go involved in that. But what we're telling you is our priority is that you do a lot of paving. And so what we gave to the police department is a big picture policy goal. It is essential. We need you to prioritize strengthening communication and trust between the Austin Police Department and our immigrant community. Here are
That's really goal number one, right?
Right.
That's the ultimate goal.
And how we think you might be able to achieve that is to increase communication with adults, increase opportunities for there to be face-to-face engagement, not television, promoted things, not public meetings where they have to, follow the rules of Robert's Rules of Order and dealing with elected officials, running it. But that there's going to be conversations between our Spanish-speaking residents and our local law enforcement, including the chief and including native Spanish speakers. And we do have a much more diverse police department than most departments in the area. And that, what we want to understand, what is their plan for going forward? Are they establishing a particular unit? Or are there individuals in the police department that are going to take the lead on this? Are there organizations that they plan to partner with to set up some of these communications? Will they be in person? Will they be, Facebook Live events? Because there's a few different ways that you can reach out to the Latino community. And we want to have a clear understanding of what is their plan for achieving the goal that we have set for them, which is to prioritize growing trust and building communication with the Spanish-speaking community.
Well, you have a leg up on other communities, like you mentioned, because you're able to observe and you're able to have more information than maybe such as some other communities in Westchester County that you may or may not have be aware of, or that you are aware of, because not everyone has all the information that your department gets. But one thing that concerns me as well is, like, you may want to reach out to the Spanish speakers in the community, but what about the non-Spanish speakers? Do they also know the standards that are going to be engaged? And do they not need also to have that one-on-one relationship with the police as well?
You know, there, we are fortunate that we do have police officers that speak other languages. The next popularly spoken language in Austin would be Portuguese, and we have multiple officers that are fluent in Portuguese as well. You're right. That is a concern. It is not the there's not the population of any other immigrant group in Austin that that even compares to the amount of impact that we have.
Well,
for
the Portuguese don't have a problem that way, and neither do the Brazilians, where they speak Portuguese, or Angola, in Africa and a couple of other places, Maputo, and Mozambique, mm-hmm. and other. So that's the list. But so they don't have the same issues, and they're not coming across the border.
Right, they're not coming in the same numbers that we're seeing from Spanish-speaking countries right now. Obviously, it's been different in different generations.
Right now.
Yeah.
Very, very fascinating. So, my God, but it must be very exciting for you, actually, to engage in these constantly evolving issues and concerns, but the fact that you do is very, very compelling. And that must engender really a lot of support, not just for you, but for the entire city. It must have some sort of a patina that gets polished because you do what you do. Do you get a sense of that when you travel about
County? I don't know about that, Hezzy. Having difficult conversations about things that really matter to our community is never easy, as you point out. And some of these things are really not cut and dry, and they're a little more nuanced. And that means that they're going to be subject to misrepresentations and oversimplifications that can be
and misunderstanding.
Misunderstood and sometimes intentionally misleading, and that's really unfortunate. We are seeing some of that. I will say, for most people who are involved in this conversation, their concerns are coming from a very genuine place, and some people genuine. I've heard this from other counterparts mm-hmm. in other communities, which is figuring out how to establish trust between local law enforcement and the immigrant community is so, so difficult. And some communities have just made the decision that having mm-hmm. as much separation between local law enforcement and ICE is essential for establishing this trust. And we mm-hmm. are choosing a different path that we think works for our community. And maybe that's just because in Austin, there has been such a concerted, overt effort to have community outreach and to have engagement between local police enforcement and the community that we believe that path can work for us and others don't see it that way. I'll tell you, yesterday I mm-hmm. spent the morning at the library with leaders from across Austin and different social service agencies and different levels of government. And I happened to be at a table where we had a small working group, and four of the members of our group were from the youth program that's from the Austin High School, which is leaders who focus on their focus is largely on keeping their peers drug free. But it goes much more broadly than that, and they've done some terrific trainings, and they've led trainings, and they've become real community leaders. And so when our conversation for the whole group was to talk about what makes people in our community feel safe and what makes people in our community, what degrades that sense of safety, and by safe I mean mm-hmm. very broadly, having safe housing, having health care, having strong education, having strong bonds in the community. And we talked about what are the things that we have and what are our challenges. And I was really a little surprised and delighted because, of course, so many of the concerns that I hear in my position are negative concerns, are fears, are complaints, are real problems, because that exists in mm-hmm. every community, especially in one as diverse as ours. And for these teens, they were all Latinos and children of immigrants, so all American themselves. Mm-hmm. They suggested that one of the things that makes them feel safe is first responders and the safety, the police, the fire, OVAC. And they knew that in their minds, if there's a crisis, if there's an emergency, they know they can call 911 and they will have the protection
right.
that they need. They just didn't question it. And I thought, and they had, you know, a very positive view of all of our first responders in Ossining, which was very reassuring for me that I've got these, you know, 16, 17, year, 18-year-old kids, all Latino, grew up in Ossining, and their impression of our first responders is that when you need help, they're there to help. And that was unprompted. I didn't say, what do you think of our police department?
Right.
They identified that as one of the resources that we have that provide safety in our community. And so I did think that that was reassuring for us going forward.
No, it was just very interesting that that was the outcome. But I guess the difference in some communities, and maybe because you're more diverse in Ossining, is the fact that for people in Ossining, it's visceral, whereas maybe for someone like me living in New York, it just seems more of a cerebral exercise. And there's a disconnect there for a lot of people who can't seem to, align themselves with or sensitive enough to recognize the fear in others.
Yeah.
And it is interesting, though, that the people in Ossining, the young people in Ossining, are very secure with emergency services, whereas in places like New York City, for example, it's not that way. I don't know how we lost that connection, but it seems to be an old standard that I thought is going to die out with people like me, because that was the way people thought of emergency services in the past in New York, but not anymore, maybe it's the last 50 or 70 years. So very interesting that you have a different dynamic in Ossining. That's very compelling.
Well, we're very fortunate.
You're doing a good job.
We
well,
do our
best. I'm not talking about you personally. I'm just talking about the city, the village, and I guess the town as well. You guys are really reaching out. I can't imagine that by not speaking to people and reaching out to them and making believe that they're not involved and yet and trying to separate the two, I think that's an impossibility. I think you need to build trust in order to be able to be recognized and also to be besieged when there is a problem. Otherwise,
right.
What do you do?
Right, right. Which is in everyone's
unbelievable.
Sense. The whole community
yeah.
needs that there to be a trust because you need people to report crimes.
Yeah.
You need people to reach out for help when they need help.
Exactly. You know, I can't believe it. You know, I'm having too much fun when I talk to you. This is not good. It's not healthy, especially when I overstay my welcome and it's already almost 10:40. And forgive me. I didn't mean to do that on purpose.
Well, thank you for indulging me in such an in-depth discussion about great things happening for kids in Ossining and the very challenging relationship that is inherent in any conversation that has to do with immigration these days in our country. And one of the things that we sort of left on in our conversation publicly, we're a completely Democratic village board, as you know, and the best way for us to address the behavior of ICE and the practices and policies related to immigration is to get people to come out and vote in November 2020. And that is actually a big focus for me in the next year. And that was one of the outcomes, I will say, in working with these kids. But our plan of action after yesterday's meeting is pre-registering high school students, because New York State, you can now start doing that at age 16, which was something
right.
they learned when we were meeting yesterday. And so I'm very excited. That is a very positive direction for us to go in so that, you know, 2 years from now, we're no longer having this conversation. We can talk about great new immigration policy that's been proposed and is moving forward.
Very, very exciting, to say the least. Thank you, Mayor Garrity. A pleasure as always.
Thank you, Hezzy. Take care.
Be well. Thank you. Well, here we have it. A very compelling always speaking with Ossining Mayor Victoria Garrity. And who knows, you know, with that sort of demeanor, it might be the place to go and settle down in. So, you know, I maybe people should look at that as well. But I guess it's not a big place. So, you know, if you're going to move now, maybe the time to move. Well, anyway, so let's find out what else is going on in our neck of the woods. Let's find out what they're doing at the Cabot Creamery. We'll cover some international news, and we'll be back.
Hey, you a judge?
Sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award.
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge.
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show.
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup.
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Well, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do?
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Welcome back. Well, you're not going to believe this. This is unbelievable news. Probably we should have all known this, but it's been hidden and quietly glossed over. That is that the trade row with Japan is heating up. And who is it heating up with? None other than South Korea, who are vowing not to be, are you listening to this, defeated again. Very, very compelling information. Well, South Korea fired back at Japan over a deepening trade dispute on Friday, pledging it would not be defeated again, quote unquote, by its neighbor, laying bare decades-old animosity at the root of a row over fast-track export status. So during a rare live television broadcast of his cabinet meeting, South Korean President Moon Jae-in threatened countermeasures after Japan's cabinet approved the removal of South Korea's fast-track export status from August 28th. Cutting South Korea from a so-called whitelist, quote-unquote, of favored export destinations means more paperwork. On-site inspections for some Japanese exporters to obtain permits, potentially slowing down exports of a wide range of goods that could be used to produce weapons. Well, relations between the two U.S. allies began to deteriorate late last year, following a row over compensation for wartime forced laborers during Japan's occupation. But the language used by President Moon was the starkest yet. Quote, we won't be defeated by Japan again, Moon told his cabinet, pointedly invoking South Korea's difficult history with Japan, which colonized the Korean Peninsula before World War II. He described Japan as a selfish nuisance, quote unquote, for disrupting global supply chains and aired suspicions over its motive for hobbling a rival economy. As part of its countermeasures, South Korea will remove Japan from its own white list of, and quote unquote, of favored trade countries and speed up the filing of a complaint to the World Trade Organization over Japan's export controls. That's what Finance Minister Hong Nam-ki had said. Well, earlier in Tokyo, Japanese Industry Minister Hiroshige Seiko told a briefing that the cabinet had taken the decision for national security reasons and it was not intended to harm bilateral relations. Well, South Korean officials have held a different perspective, particularly since last month when Japan tightened curbs on exports to South Korea of three high-tech materials needed to make memory chips and display panels, threatening the global supply of chips. Well, so while Japan justified its decision on national security grounds, it has also pointed to an erosion of trust since South Korean court rulings ordered Japanese firms to compensate wartime forced laborers. Now, Tokyo, and this goes back to World War II, mind you. So Tokyo says that issue was settled by a 1965 treaty that normalized ties between the two countries. Quote, we want South Korea to first create an environment in which we can have dialogue with trust. It's South Korea's responsibility to do that, the industry minister Seiko had said.
Well, the rift is the latest example of how a decades-old disagreement has undermined relations between the two U.S. allies at a time when Washington wants them working together on North Korea. It is also awkward economically, as both export-driven economies are facing sliding demand from China. Well, Tokyo has been frustrated by what it calls a lack of action by Seoul after South Korea's top court ruled last year that a Japanese steelmaker should compensate former forced laborers. Well, South Korea would be the first country to be removed from Japan's whitelist, which currently has 27 countries, including Germany, Britain, and the United States. Now, Seiko said that Japan was unwilling to hold a dialogue until South Korea corrected a statement made at a July meeting between bureaucrats of the two countries. Japan has disputed a Korean official's comment that Seoul asked Japan to repeal the export curbs at that July meeting. And Tokyo has also accused South Korea of breaking an agreement on what the two sides would disclose from the meeting. Well, South Korean officials, for their part, have warned they may reconsider an intelligence-sharing accord with Japan if the feud worsens. This is unbelievable what's going on. So the United States has urged its two key Asian allies to consider reaching a, quote, standstill agreement, quote, unquote, to buy more time for talks, a senior U.S. administration official told reporters in Washington on Tuesday. Well, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said on Thursday, yesterday, he hoped the two would find a solution by themselves, stressing cooperation on North Korea was incredibly important, quote unquote. Seiko said Japan had briefed the United States administration on its plans, and the issue revolves around the chips. So the fresh restrictions could deal an additional blow to South Korean chip makers, which are already scrambling to secure key chip making material after last month's export curbs. South Korea's top imports from Japan by value last year were semiconductor components and equipment, ranging from silicon wafers to chip etching machines, totaled at about $11 billion, nearly 20% of Japanese imports, according to data provided by Korea International Trade Association. So, Moody's Investor Service said Japan's removal of South Korea from the whitelist is a credit negative for many South Korean companies. Mm. South Korea's central bank chief also flagged concerns that Japan's move can significantly impact the economy. On Thursday, South Korea reported its exports had tumbled for the eighth straight month in July, with the escalating trade dispute adding to an increasingly gloomy picture. Is this amazing when you come to think about it? This is happening years and years after the war, 74, 75 years since the war ended. And here we are, and never been able to put this issue to bed. And it probably will never die until all the people who have memory, physical memory of that, those days, actually die. And it seems as the only solution, and even then, rather than have lucid concepts and thinking from a population that lived through this all, whether you hear the Japanese side or the Korean side, what happens here is that the history will be rewritten and maligned quite often by people who do not know, who were not there, who didn't feel the pain, and can only try to contemplate. It becomes a cerebral exercise, but it's not visceral. And it's hard to replicate that in a manner that is conducive to a reality that existed that may not exist now, but it needs to be revealed for what it was and the pain it caused. And then you almost see here the circumstance and the need for accommodation to great nations, Korea and Japan, coming together after the World War, and also the Japanese invasion of China and Korea. It was a different time, and
And that's it. That's the reality. But a very fascinating turn of events. I had not expected it to be this visceral, but evidently it still is. And I mean, just to be able to hear the concept that South Korea vows not to be, quote, defeated again, that's gut-wrenching. That is really gut-wrenching. And I wouldn't have expected to be forgotten, but I wouldn't have thought that it had come to that point where it elevated to such a high in-your-face pain. But evidently, it's still there. And it needs to be respected for what it is, which is fascinating as well. Well, so that's the story about that. Now, let's see if we can cover some more news that you may find interesting as well. 1 second. Now, this is really interesting because this goes against the grain for some people here in the United States and some people in the other parts of the world, but scientists are linking the European heat wave to man-made global warming. Well, it seems the heat wave that smashed temperature records in Western Europe last month was made more likely and intensified by man-made climate change, according to a study published today. The rapid study by a respected team of European scientists should be a warning of things to come, the report's lead author had said. What will be the impacts on agriculture? What will the impacts on water be? Said Robert Vautard of the Institut Pierre-Simon Laplace in France. This will put real tension in society that we may not be so well equipped to cope with, he said. The report concluded that the heat wave in late July was so extreme over continental Western Europe that the observed magnitudes would have been extremely unlikely without climate change. In countries where millions of people sweltered through the heat wave, temperatures would have been 2.7 to 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit lower in a world without human-induced climate change, the study said. That's huge. Well, global warming is also making such extreme heat more frequent. The study by experts from France, the Netherlands, Britain, Switzerland, and Germany had found. Well, the scientists said that the record temperatures recorded in France and the Netherlands could happen every 50 to 150 years in the world's current climate. And without human influence on climate, quote-unquote, the temperatures would likely happen less than once in 1,000 years. Now, Vautard said that Europe needs to get used to such heat waves, which are likely to become more frequent and intense. This will go up, and if we don't do anything about climate change, about emissions, these heat waves, which today have a amplitude of about 115 degrees, they will have 3 degrees more in 2050, so that it is going to make about 125 degrees, roughly speaking, he advised the Associated Press. Well, while the heat wave broke in Western Europe after a few days late last month, the extreme temperatures have since shifted north and are causing massive ice melts in Greenland and the Arctic. The scientists calculated the odds of this type of heat occurring now and how often it would have happened in a world without man-made global warming and compared them. They created the simulations by using 8 different sets of complex computer models. The U.S. National Academy of Science in 2016 studied this new scientific method of climate attribution and pronounced it valid. Well, Kathy Dello, a climate scientist from North Carolina State University in North Carolina, said that the study helps to pin the blame for the heat wave on climate change. If searching for a culprit for the intensity of these recent European heat waves, climate change is the obvious culprit, Dello said in an email. Attribution is just dusting for fingerprints. Climate change will continue to be a menace when it comes to extreme heat, making these events more likely and more intense, end quote. another expert not connected to the study by the name of Celine Bonfil of the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California said the findings are clear. Record hot weather events are becoming more likely, and human-induced climate change is causing the increase in heat wave frequency, end quote. The new report agreed with their assessments, saying that every recent European heat wave that has been analyzed, quote, was found to be made much more likely and more intense due to human-induced climate change, end quote. That seems like a period and an emphasis that one would never have heard even 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. But the reality is starting to hit, which is very, very compelling, actually, to say the least. Now, let's see. There is consternation, which continues anyway, no matter what we try to do. It seems that thousands of Hong Kong civil servants have joined the wave of protests. Thousands of Hong Kong civil servants rallied today at night. It's like 12 hours ahead or 13 hours ahead of us in Asia, like in places like Japan and China. So they rallied Friday night to support protesters and urged authorities to rebuild confidence in the government as escalating protests rock the Asian financial hub. Here we're talking Hong Kong. The rally is the first time government employees have prompted a demonstration in Hong Kong. Civil servants assembled peacefully with protesters in the heart of the business district, many in black masks to hide their identity. I think the government should respond to the demands instead of pushing the police to the front lines as a shield, said Kathy Yip, a 26-year-old government worker. Police said they had arrested 8 people, including a leading pro-independence leader, after seizing weapons and suspected bomb-making material in a raid. A wave of protests is planned across Hong Kong this weekend, along with a mass strike on Monday across sectors such as transport, schools, and corporations that could bring the city to a standstill. The protests in Hong Kong, a former British colony that was returned to China in 1997, poses one of the gravest populist challenges to Communist Party rulers in Beijing. So the protests against a now suspended extradition bill, which would have seen people sent for trial in mainland courts controlled by the Communist Party, widened to demand greater democracy and the resignation of Hong Kong's leader, Carrie Lam, L-A-M. Under Chinese rule, Hong Kong has been allowed to retain extensive freedoms such as an independent judiciary, but many residents see the extradition bill as the latest step in a relentless march towards mainland control. At present, the people of Hong Kong are already on the verge of collapse, a group of civil servants said in an open letter to Lam, L-A-M. Now, Hong Kong has always been well-behaved and enjoys a high degree of freedom. It is a pity that we have seen extreme oppression. It asked Lam to respond positively to 5 public demands: complete withdrawal of the extradition bill, a hold to descriptions of the protests as rioting, a waiver of charges against those arrested, an independent inquiry, and resumption of political reform. The city's 180,000 civil servants must remain politically neutral, the government said on Thursday. At this difficult moment, government colleagues have to stay united and work together to uphold the core values of the civil service, it said in a statement. Hundreds of medical workers also demonstrated on Friday to protest against the government's handling of the situation. Large-scale protests are planned for the weekend in Mong Kok, Tsung Kwan O, and Western districts. Clashes between protesters and police have become increasingly violent, and police have been criticized for excessive use of force and failing to protect protesters from attacks by what opposition politicians suspected are criminal gangs. in a warning to protesters, China's People's Liberation Army in Hong Kong on Wednesday released a video of anti-riot exercises, and its top brass warned violence was, quote, absolutely impermissible, end quote. The People's, People's Liberation Army has remained in barracks since protests started in April, leaving Hong Kong's police force to deal with protests. Now, police said seven men and a woman aged between 24 and 31 were arrested on Friday after a raid on a building in the New Territories district of Sha Tin, where police seized weapons and suspected petroleum bombs or gasoline bombs, making or possessing explosives illegally can carry a sentence of up to 14 years in jail. Well, the police may arrest more people as the investigations unfold, police officer Lee Kwai Hua had said, adding, quote, recently we are very worried about the escalating violence, end quote. Andy Chan, a founder of the pro-independence Hong Kong National Party that was banned last September, was among those arrested. His arrest prompted about 100 protesters to surround a police station to demand his release, television footage had shown. And on Wednesday, 44 people were charged in a Hong Kong court with rioting over a recent protest near Beijing's main representative office in the heart of the city. The escalating protests, which have shut government offices, blocked roads, and disrupted businesses, taking a toll of the city's economy and scaring off tourists. I tell you, it's amazing. The world is in turmoil. It really is in turmoil wherever you look, and it seems to be a real, real problem. Let's go over to another hot point. India is warning tourists to leave Kashmir over terror threats. Well, Indian authorities on Friday told tourists to leave Kashmir because of terror threats, quote-unquote, as media reports said 25,000 military reinforcements have been sent to the troubled Himalayan region. The extra troops and other security measures, including a call to stockpile food and fuel, have shaken the Muslim-majority region, which is also claimed by Pakistan. Long lines of cars formed outside gasoline stations while residents queued or lined up at food stores and bank cash machines to get emergency supplies. The Jammu and Kashmir state government said that because of, quote, intelligence inputs of terror threats, end quote, against a huge Hindu pilgrimage and, quote, the prevailing security situation, end quote, pilgrims and tourists should leave immediately, quote, end quote. India's military head in Kashmir, Lieutenant General Kanwaljeet Singh Dhillon, said a sniper gun and a mine with Pakistani markings had been found on the route of the Amarnath Yatra pilgrimage that draws hundreds of thousands of Hindus each year. This proves Pakistani attempts to attack the Yatra, said Singh, who has 500,000 forces in Kashmir battling a three-decade insurgency. India and Pakistan divided Kashmir when they became independent in 1947 and have fought two of three wars since over the territory. The Indian government has admitted that 10,000 extra troops were sent to Kashmir a week ago. Media reports said Friday that an additional 25,000 troops have been ordered there as well. Kashmir's police chief, Dilbagh Singh, called the new figure exaggerated, end quote. As tensions build, near daily clashes between Indian forces with separatist militants in Kashmir and Pakistan forces across the border go on. Two Indian soldiers were killed last week in cross-border firing from Pakistan-Kashmir and a siege of separatist rebels, authorities said. And two militants accused of staging attacks on the Indian government forces were also killed in a gun battle, according to police. Residents and Kashmir politicians fear the security is a preliminary smokescreen before the Hindu nationalist government carries out a threat to scrap special job and property rights for Kashmiris. Political leaders in the territory have warned that canceling the constitutional guaranteed rights could spark unrest. Add to public nerves, a police order to gather details on every mosque and its leaders was leaked on social media last week. A top police official speaking on condition of anonymity, said that officers have been, quote, advised, end quote, to send their families to safe places and build up food reserves. Many owners of gasoline stations said officials have also asked them to keep vehicle fuel stocks at full capacity. It's part of a constantly changing security plan to counter a possible public uprising, the police said. A statement by Jammu and Kashmir State Governor Satya Pal Malik had said, quote, everything is normal, quote, unquote, in the region, has not convinced the public. Well, the anxiety among Kashmiris is real, as this government had not hidden its intentions, said Noor Ahmad Baba, a political commentator and political professor at the University of Kashmir. Now, Article 35A of the Constitution, which prevents Indians from outside the territory buying land or claiming government jobs in Kashmir, has long been targeted by Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The article has been challenged in the Supreme Court by right-wing Hindu groups, and Modi's Hindu Nationalist Party has promised to repeal it even without court backing. Kashmir has surged back into the spotlight since a deadly militant attack on an Indian convoy back in February, claimed by a Pakistan-based group, sparked cross-border air attacks by the nuclear-armed rivals. U.S. President Donald Trump angered India last month when he said that Modi had asked him to mediate in the Kashmir dispute. Trump reaffirmed an offer to mediate on Thursday. Each time, India has insisted that the festering dispute can only be resolved bilaterally. Well, very compelling perspective, that is for sure, and very frightening as well. It's that has never died down since 1947. Can you imagine? I was born 3 years later, but it certainly has an impact. I've always known about that. I don't know why. But always seemed to be very important for me to know what was going on in India and in Pakistan. Well, let's see what else is going on. And this is really very interesting as well. On a different note, the United States is going to withdraw officially from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Well, the United States will officially withdraw from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, INF, treaty on Friday. That's today. Clearing the way for a new arms race with Russia and throwing China into the mix. The treaty concluded by then U.S. President Ronald Reagan and Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev in 1987 limited the Cold War powers' medium-range missiles, both conventional and nuclear. Earlier this year, U.S. President Donald Trump's administration announced its intention to ditch the agreement, accusing Moscow of repeatedly violating its terms, a charge naturally that you'd expect Russia denied. Well, I think the INF treaty has served us well, but it only works if both parties comply, the new U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper said recently. The United States will remain in compliance with all of our obligations until the 2nd of August. That's today, folks. And after that point, in time, we will continue to pursue what is in our best interest, he told lawmakers. Now, Washington formally launched the procedure of leaving the treaty on February 1, a six-month process. Russian President Vladimir Putin signed into law a bill suspending Moscow's participation on July 3rd. Unless something changes in the coming days, the mutual withdrawal will spell the end of the deal, which eliminated a range of missiles with ranges of 500 to 5,000 kilometers, that's from 310 miles to 3,420 miles. That paved the way for the mothballing of Russian SS-20 missiles and American Pershing missiles deployed in Europe. Well, even if European nations have expressed concern about the consequence of a new arms race, NATO endorsed the U.S. position, saying that Russia's 9M729 missile had violated the international agreement. So, Moscow insists the new projectile has a maximum range of 480 kilometers within the INF parameters. Well, the Americans disagree. In the end, the death of the INF treaty suits Washington just fine, as former Defense Secretary Ash Carter said in early July. Quote, from the military point of view, not the political point of view, it's not so bad, Carter said at a conference at the Council of Foreign Relations. We can make good use of what we call conventional prompt strike. The Pentagon is thrilled that it will now be able to modernize its arsenal to counter the mounting might of China, which is looking to assert its military supremacy in Asia. Most of China's inventory is of intermediate-range missiles, and so we need to make sure we have the capability as well to respond should we, God forbid, he says, get a fight with them one day, Esper said. Well, the United States has pledged not to deploy new nuclear-armed missiles in Europe, but made no such promise on the deployment of conventional weapons. Advances in technology have allowed for the development of mid-range missiles that are much more precise than those made 30 years ago, explained the career diplomat William Courtney, who is now a senior fellow at the nonprofit, nonpartisan RAND Corporation. Well, the technology has changed so much that it makes it militarily attractive, said Courtney with respect to an arms control, because he's an expert on that field. Now, for Thomas Mankin, professor of strategic studies at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, the U.S. must now deploy medium-range conventional weapons on its islands in the Pacific and other territory controlled by its allies. Such a move would help counter China's rise, especially in the South China Sea, where the People's Liberation Army has effectively commandeered several disputed islands. It is time to turn the tables, Mankin, M-A-H-N, K-E-N said in a commentary published on the specialist website War on the Rocks. Such weapons, capable of denying China the use of littoral waters, would be a powerful deterrent to Chinese aggression. Such a move seems to have the support of the next chairman of the United States Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley. When asked by U.S. senators about the imminent demise of the INF Treaty, he said, he supported the deployment of conventional ground-based medium-range missiles in the Indo-Pacific region. You think those would be helpful, one senator asked. I do, Milley replied. Well, there's the story. Unbelievable. Tension wherever you look. So where are the voices of reason that can reason so that both sides or all sides involved in these disputes can come to an accommodation? And what is it that we're bumping up against? Well, there is some forward movement, which was unexpected, that's for sure. Saudi Arabia is going to let adult women travel without permission from a male guardian. That's what the state media had said. Well, Saudi Arabia has allowed adult women to travel without permission and granted them more control over family matters, further eroding a heavily criticized male guardianship system at a time of heightened scrutiny over its human rights record. Well, the decisions issued in a series of cabinet decrees published by the Official Gazette on Friday today stipulate that a Saudi passport should be issued to any citizen that applies for it and that any person above the age of 21 does not need permission to travel. The amendments to regulations also grant women, for the first time, the right to register childbirth, marriage, or divorce, and to be issued official family documents and be eligible as a guardian to children who are minors. Riyadh has long endured international censure over the status of women who rights groups say are often treated as second-class citizens under rules requiring them to get the consent of a male guardian for important decisions throughout their entire lives, regardless of age. We're talking about even kids. You know, a six-year-old kid needs to be there in the presence of this woman, of an adult woman. Do you believe this? It's unbelievable. But anyway, that's the way they live. The kingdom's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, has eased social restrictions, such as lifting a driving ban for women last year, as part of a push to open up the conservative Muslim kingdom and transform the economy. Last year's murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the hands of Saudi agents caused a global outcry, however, and the Gulf Arab state has been widely criticized for the arrest and alleged torture of nearly a dozen women activists. Several high-profile cases of young women seeking asylum abroad on claims of gender-based repression have added further pressure on Riyadh over the male guardian system. or guardianship status between law and custom makes it a thorny issue for Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who indicated last year he favored ending the system but stopped short of endorsing its annulment. The decrees published on Friday, today, also covered employment regulations that would expand work opportunities for women who represent a big portion of unemployed Saudis. They stipulate that all citizens have the right to work without facing any discrimination based on gender, disability, or age. Well, Prince Mohammed bin Salman unveiled an ambitious plan in 2016 to transform the economy by 2030, which envisages increasing women's participation in the workforce to 30% from the present 22. Very, very evolutionary in their thinking at present, which is really amazing. Now, this is really very interesting because I didn't think this would come into play, but it has. It's been a week in review, so there are a lot of issues that are taking place. Well, let me just look and see what else. Here it is. French authorities are under pressure to shed light on the death of Steve Canisso, 24, after police firing tear gas and concertgoers scattering into the Loire River during the June 21 Fête de la Musique, France's annual live music festival. And, people are holding signs up saying that they want to gain justice for Steve. So that is a very, very big issue. And we'll see where that goes. This is interesting as well. This is also happening in Paris. Syrian artists and activists in Paris have launched a fourth edition of something they call Syrian Nefe, an annual festival that pays tribute to the victims and refugees of the war in Syria through paintings, photography, music, and cuisine. So very, very interesting as well. And one second. Okay, so I think that that's basically it there. Let me just quickly see if there's anything else that's transpired that we should give notice to. One second. Oh, this is unexpected as well. Oh, it took a long time. Evidently, Syria has agreed to conditional ceasefire in the last rebel stronghold. So Syria's government said it has agreed to a conditional ceasefire starting late Thursday, that means yesterday, in the country's last rebel bastion, the northwestern Idlib province, where aid agencies say the regime's offensive is growing bloodier. Well, government troops and allied Russian warplanes have been carrying out a three-month offensive against the rebels' last stronghold, which has displaced hundreds of thousands and has hit health facilities and other infrastructure. The decision came hours after UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres authorized an investigation into attacks on health facilities and schools in the rebel-held enclave following a petition from 10 members of the United Nations Security Council. Well, images of attacks on health facilities and residential homes were reminiscent of the peak of the violence in Syria's eight-year conflict. International rights groups, Western countries, and the United Nations had appealed for a ceasefire in the rebel-held area, which is home to around 3 million people. However, a war monitoring group, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, said there was no sign of a ceasefire on Thursday. It said intense clashes continued on the southern edge of the rebel stronghold. The ceasefire announced on state media through an unnamed military official is conditional on the rebels retreating about 12 and a half miles deep and away from demilitarized areas that ring the stronghold. Well, Idlib has supposed to be a de-escalation zone under an agreement signed last September by Russia, a key Syrian government ally, and Turkey, which backed the opposition. failure to implement the retreat and disarmament of militants was one of the reasons why the September ceasefire collapsed. At that time, the retreat was for up to 15 miles in some areas. The government declaration comes as a new round of talks sponsored by Russia began on Thursday in the Kazakh capital, attended by Iran and Turkey. The Syrian government and the opposition are also in attendance. On Thursday, United Nations spokesman Stefan Dujarric said Guterres was using his authority under the UN Charter to establish an internal board of inquiry to ascertain facts on the destruction and damage of civilian facilities that featured on the so-called deconfliction, quote-unquote, list given to the warring parties to prevent attacks. United Nations humanitarian chief Mark Lowcock urged an end to the bombing and shelling in Idlib by Syrian and Russian warplanes, warning the Security Council on Tuesday that continued violence could create the worst humanitarian disaster of the 21st century. Well, it's going to be very interesting. Who's the United Nations going to blame this time? Well, the petition from 10 Security Council members was delivered to Guterres on Tuesday, asking for an investigation into attacks on medical facilities and other sites on the deconfliction list. Russia's Deputy United Nations Ambassador Dmitry Polyansky, whose country backs the Syrian government, told reporters on Thursday that Moscow was, quote, amazed, end quote, at Guterres' decision to establish an investigation, calling it, quote, a mistake, end quote, and questioning whether the United Nations chief had the authority to take such action. This is unbelievable pushback. Well, Susanna Siokin, a policy director at Physicians for Human Rights, told the council during a meeting on Tuesday on the humanitarian situation in Syria that, quote, since President Bashar al-Assad launched the recent offensive, the organization had received reports of 46 attacks on healthcare facilities. So far, she said, it has verified 16 of them. Well, there's 30 more to go. Or humanitarian chief Lowcock said it was an extremely important question, quote unquote, whether information provided through the deconfliction system was being used to protect civilian facilities or to target them. He told the council on Tuesday that parties to the conflict have been notified of 6 different attacks in northwest Syria this year, and that, quote, in the current environment, deconfliction is not proving effective in helping to protect those who utilize the system, end quote. Syrian first responders, known as the White Helmets, said on Thursday that during the 3-month offensive on Idlib, government forces and their allies had targeted 15 of the group's rescue centers and killed 7 volunteers. This is the trouble that keeps on giving, which is unbelievable, just unbelievable. Now, let's just quickly look and see what's going on. This is very, very interesting. It's the last thing we'll do today, and that is take an eye on Africa. Well, got to listen to this. Evidently, Mozambique rivals have signed a historic peace deal. I have been to Maputo, the capital of Mozambique. I just adored it. There was so much, something about Africa that just grabs you. And it'll never stop. Okay, this is about a 12-minute run.
Thousands of people take to the streets across the country to protest the killing of students earlier this week. And doctors in Goma say a 4th person has tested positive for Ebola. The news comes as Rwandan officials deny they closed the border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. But first, it's a major step toward peace in Mozambique. President Filipe Nyusi and the leader of the main opposition party, RENAMO, have signed a permanent ceasefire agreement. It's designed to put an end to decades of hostilities that have flared since the end of the country's civil war in 1992. Catherine Kadir Clifford has the details.
Embracing a peaceful future. Mozambique's President Filipe Nyusi and the leader of the RENAMO opposition, Osifo Mamadi, mark an end to decades of hostility.
To our brother Filipe Jacinto Nyusi, President of the Republic, we extend our appreciation for having broken down the forces that oppose dialogue.
The location is symbolic. Gorongosa National Park is close to RENAMO's armed base. This is the country's third attempt at a peace accord since 2016, a culmination of years of negotiations to end fighting that has flared several times since the end of the country's 1976 to 1992 civil war. The conflict broke out a year after the country declared independence from Portugal. An estimated 1 million people were killed and several million displaced.
August 1st, 2019 will forever be remembered in the history of the Mozambican people as the day that brothers said enough to war between them and embraced to develop Mozambique.
This time around, some key issues have been agreed in advance. The government has signed over amnesty to some 5,200 rebel fighters who began disarming earlier this week. They'll be given financial aid to facilitate their return to civilian life, and some will be integrated into the army and police. RENAMO is already an opposition party present in parliament, and following the accord, will be able to stand in provincial elections for the first time. A final agreement is set to be signed in the capital next week, pledging peace in October 15th elections, a vote which will put the new accord to the test.
Four protesters have been killed and several others injured in the Sudanese city of Omdurman on Thursday. Hundreds of thousands of people had taken to the streets across the country after organizers called for a million-person march to protest the killing of students earlier this week. Mario Sofos has the latest.
Piling pressure on Sudan's military rulers, hundreds of thousands of protesters took to the streets of the country on Thursday. In the city of Omdurman, across the river from Khartoum, medics reported that several protesters were shot dead and others injured by gunfire. Along with protesters in the capital and other cities, they were rallying against the killing of fellow demonstrators earlier in the week and over recent months, as well as calling for the army to hand over power to the people.
Today is a special day. It is a day for the martyrs who died for this country. The martyrs of December till the ones of today, until the revolution gets its rights.
We're asking the military council to hand over power because this is a civilian revolution. We've had enough because our husbands and our children have died for this country.
Organizers had called for 1 million people to come out and march in response to the killing of six people, including four schoolchildren, in El Obeid on Monday. The talks between protest leaders and Sudan's military chiefs were meant to resume on Thursday with the aim of finalizing a power-sharing agreement, the outline of which had been decided on last month. This week's violence, however, does not bode well for the resolution of Sudan's ongoing political crisis.
The World Health Organization has confirmed there is now a fourth case of Ebola in the city of Goma in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Doctors in the North Kivu province said the wife of the man who died of Ebola this week tested positively for the virus. Meanwhile, Rwanda's health minister said the border with the DRC remained open on Thursday. That contradicts an earlier statement which reported the border had been closed. Earlier, I spoke to Emanuele Capobianco, the director of health and care at the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. He has an update on the situation.
What we know is that the men who contracted the disease in the north of the country came to Goma with a cold, got sick, and was hospitalized only 2 days. There was a long period in which he was infected and he was living in Goma with his family. So it's not surprising that two members of the immediate family got sick, and there is the potential of more immediate contacts in the country.
And how are your teams on the ground responding to that possibility of other people in the city becoming sick?
So there is a large response of the Red Cross and all departments that are in Goma that have been preparing over the past several weeks and months for this opportunity, for this eventuality. So we do have vaccination teams on the ground. We have increased surveillance. We have an Ebola treatment center open and functioning. We have isolation centers. We do have a safe indigenous fight burial teams manned by Red Cross volunteers that are on the ground ready to provide burials to people who died from Ebola or are suspected of dying from Ebola, including the men who were buried today.
So the World Health Organization declared the crisis a public health emergency of international concern about 2 weeks ago. That has, of course, helped increase response on the ground. But how do organizations and health workers deal with the continuing threat of violence in the region and sometimes against them?
The violence has been a constant problem over the year-long efforts to contain this epidemic. The best way to fight violence is by getting the communities, the families on the side of the responders. And this is done by engaging communities, making sure that they understand what the disease is about, understand what a vaccine is, to understand why going to a Ebola assessment center is not a death center that many fear, but is actually sometimes the only opportunity for a person to survive. If we get communities on board, the violence will decrease, and this is what has been happening over the past 6 months. So I think to continue to do so and now on a larger scale.
Yeah, of course, and we've had more than 1,800 people that have died from this outbreak since last year. Why is it that we're still seeing new cases? What needs to be done to put a definitive end to the outbreak?
The outbreak is happening in a very difficult zone. The virus has been moving extremely fast, and somehow responders have been changing. We need to do a few things. One is ensuring that we increase the quality of the response, the extent of the response, and particularly we strengthen the community systems. Second, we need to make sure that there is engagement of families, communities, so that they are part of this. Third, we need to make sure that the response is not only focused on Ebola, but we also tackle those other health needs and humanitarian needs that are critical for the population. That will get the community support and engagement that is absolutely needed to turn this epidemic around. We have all the tools that are needed. We need to be brought to scale. We need to have the operational ability to bring this in all the locations where the virus is appearing.
The Somalian government says the mayor of the city of Mogadishu has died after he was badly injured in a terror attack last week. Abdirahman Omar Osman died of his injuries in Qatar on Thursday, where he had been airlifted following the attack. The female suicide bomber belonging to the Al-Shabaab group entered the mayor's office on July 24th before detonating her explosives. Both the group and Somali officials believe the target of the attack was James Swan, the UN's new envoy to Somalia. Swan left the office just minutes before the explosion. Mauritania has a new president. Mohamed Ould Ghazouani was sworn into office on Thursday. The new leader was a general in the country's army before serving as defense minister. Simon Harding takes a closer look at the man who will now lead the country of 4.5 million.
He's only Mauritania's second ever democratically elected president. The right-hand man of former president Mohamed Ould Abdelaziz, Mohamed Ould Ghazouani, has now been sworn in and takes over as leader of Mauritania, continuing the dominance of the Union for the Republic political party, formed by Ould Abdelaziz in 2009. Often making decisions backstage on behalf of his predecessor, General Ghazouani has had a long military career. Twice, he was part of military coups that overthrew the head of state, the latest in 2008, when alongside Ould Abdelaziz, he deposed Sidi Ould Sheikh Abdallahi. In 2008, he was named as Mauritania's chief of defense, a position he held for 10 years before being appointed as defense minister of Mauritania in October 2018. The son of a spiritual tribe leader, Ghazouani has promised to be the president of all Mauritanians, to strengthen the army and security in Mauritania, but in particular, to address the drastic differences in social equality and class in Mauritanian society.
That does it for this edition of Eye on Africa. The news continues on France 24 right after this.
Well, that's the story there. So I think that's the end of our broadcast day today. And I wish you a great weekend. And we'll speak to you on Monday. And let's see what we have on Monday. We always have Michael Edelman and John Bailey. So we'll have them. Oh, my God, it's going to be the 5th of August on Monday. So John Bailey at 10 to 10:30, Michael Edelman from 10:30 to 11. And then we'll do some other stuff afterwards. So that's the story. All right. Have a great weekend. Be well. And thanks for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you to Austin Mayor Victoria Garrity. Always is a pleasure with her. Thank you. Goodbye.